All right, let's begin John. We're going to spend the entirety of our discussion today on John. This is, in a sense, it's going to be very survey-ish because we're going to cover 21 chapters in 30 minutes. It's going to be different than our survey in that we are actually going to focus on a single book. We're going to be talking about less, more in terms of content and less in terms of survey, interesting, historical, critical issues. Not that we won't be talking about any, but we'll be talking about them less. All right, here's how we're going to break up the Gospel of John today. If you want to write this down, we're going to start with a prologue, first chapter. The second section, well, the first primary section is what we're going to call the Book of Signs. It's chapters 2 through 12. And I'm going to follow the outline of this guy, fantastic fellow, C.H. Dodd. I believe Edward was with me when I managed to find this on the bookshelf before he did at Half Price Books. Fantastic book. It is, of course, out of print and probably hard to find and quite possibly expensive. I got it for cheap. I got it for $12.49. So this was the Half Price Books at Campbell, $75. So he's a fantastic scholar. He was has been big, but this was written mid-century, last century. Smart guy. I don't know where you'd put him on the whole, if you want to put somebody on a spectrum of conservative to liberal. I really don't know exactly where you'd put him, but very useful. I've read some of his stuff before, and this book had lots of interesting ideas. So this first major section, Book of Signs, chapters 2 through 12, we're going to break that into seven signs. First one is the sign of water to wine, which is chapter 2 through 4:42. The second is the life-giving word, chapter 4:46. Excuse me? The life-giving word, chapter 4. The previous one might have gone through verse 45, but you get the point. 4:46 through 5:47. This is the life-giving word. The third section is the bread of life, chapter 6. The fourth section is what he calls light and life, manifestation and rejection. That's 7 and 8. The fifth one is judgment by the light, 9:1 through 10:39. Number 6, by the light. That's 9:1 through 10:39, the end of 10, 9 and 10. Judgment by the light. The sixth is victory of life over death. That's chapter 11. And the last part of this is life through death, chapter 12. The next major part is the Book of the Passion, chapters 13 to 22, broken up into two sections. Discourses, that's 13 through 17. And the actual Passion story, which is 18 through 20, followed by an epilogue, which is the last chapter. So that's the general outline that he gives, and I think it actually works pretty well. There's the Book of the Passion, which is 13 to 20. It had two pieces. The first piece was dialogues. The last section of the Book of Signs is Life Through Death, chapter 12. And I'll mention these again as we actually go through it and discuss each individual section. First section of the Book of the Passion is the section of dialogues. So that's 13 through, 17? The last section is 18 through 20 of that, which is the actual passion, when he is actually betrayed, arrested, crucified, resurrected. And then the final chapter, and it is separated out for a reason. We'll discuss that. Chapter 21, some sort of an epilogue. I wouldn't really call it a conclusion, because that's something else, but that's that. So that's the Gospel of John in a nutshell, at least according to the breakdown of Dodd. You might want to reshuffle various things in the Book of Signs. You might end certain things, you might see things a little bit differently, but at least the broad settings are fairly clearly defined. At least I think so. And then the middle sections, some of them are very clear thematically. Some of them, you look at some of the people and go, yeah, this might fit here, this might not fit there, and whatnot. And then, of course, at 13, that's when Jesus washes the disciples' feet. And so there, we're very clearly getting into the passion, the narrative up to the passion. Because when does he wash his disciples' feet? Right before that begins. So in the upper room. Okay, so John, let's start at the beginning. The second most well-known portion of the book, of course, the most well-known being John 3:16. Second most, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. So if you start that off, you really get a little bit a different kind of feel than what you would get with the synoptics. Some people have made a distinction between the synoptics, which we discussed last time, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, saying the synoptics, they're the historical gospels, where John is the spiritual gospel. Perhaps not. That's not the most appropriate way to distinguish the two, but in terms of how they deal with their material and what they bring to the fore, there's very clearly a difference between the two. John has really long dialogues and is quite openly, quite very clearly trying to bring in a higher view of Christ quite explicitly more than the other Gospels. It's not that the others don't discuss this and don't have implications for our understanding of Christology. They do, and we discussed that when we went through Mark that time. We saw a number of places where we thought, this is clearly encoded Jewish thought of saying that this man is Yahweh. We saw that a number of times in Mark, but it is much more explicit in John, as I'm sure you know. Whenever you're debating Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons and whatnot, this is often a favorite book to go to for material because it is quite explicit. You have to go through amazing hoops to try to explain away some of the very obvious statements here, like Thomas's declaration at the end of the book, "My Lord and my God," or even this first verse, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." That you have to go through some interesting hoops to try to divert people from the obvious meaning of that. So that's John. It's that way. When you read the synoptics, sure there's dialogues, sure there's theology, but there's more of a narrative focus, I guess you could say. And then, of course, as we talked about last time, thematically, they stick together. Now, one thing that's similar between all of the Gospels, even though some of them have something of a prologue, at the very beginning of all of them, at the very beginning of Jesus' ministry, they all have John the Baptist. So you have that in verse 6. "There was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to bear witness about the light, that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but came to bear witness about the light." And then you get to verse 19, and this is the testimony of John. "When the Jews sent priests and Levites to Jerusalem to ask him, 'Who are you?' he confessed and did not deny, but confessed, 'I am not the Christ.' And they asked him, 'What then? Are you Elijah?' He said, 'I am not.'" Of course, was he Elijah? He was actually Elijah, yeah. "Are you the prophet?" And he answered, "No." So they said to him, "Who are you? We need to give an answer to those who sent us. What do you say about yourself?" And here's that verse again. He said, "I am the voice of one crying out in the wilderness, 'Make straight the path of the Lord,' as the prophet Isaiah said." There's that verse. So it makes a showing at the beginning of Jesus' ministry for all of the Gospels. That, to me, is very interesting. That ends up being centerpiece to bringing in Jesus' ministry. Of course, we spent more time, a lot of time talking about that verse in the context of Mark. But in the context of what's really going on in all of them, and then Jesus's ministry is essentially this. The original context of that verse was to say, God is bringing his people out of captivity. He's bringing them from darkness to light. He's bringing them from slavery to freedom. He's bringing them from the land of sin back to the land that God gave them. All of those images apply very well to this. That's the purpose of the verse. And so what is clear in all of the Gospels, forefront, is that's what Jesus is doing. He is bringing his people out of their exile to sin, darkness, slavery, and whatnot. So the testimony of John the Baptist, it's a little different in all the Gospels. This one has a really interesting one at the very beginning. Let's see, this would be 29. The next day, he saw Jesus coming toward him and said, "Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." Of course, as a general rule, people will commonly go, okay, well, Lamb of God, we think of lamb being slaughtered. Okay, well, John the Baptist is already recognizing the sacrificial, the expiatory death of Christ here at the beginning of John. That's at least the normal view, because whenever we think of lamb, we think passive, we think dumb, we think quiet, we think doesn't fight back. That's the lamb. I think that is utterly wrong in this view, in terms of what John is going for and really what Judaism thought of. If you think back to the lamb in Revelation, he was the lamb who was slain, but what is the lamb doing? What is the lamb doing in Revelation? He's making war, right? Whenever I was going to seminary, I guess it was second year, there was a guy who was working on a thesis, and I thought this was somewhat a new view, but it actually isn't view. I see it in Dodd. And his thesis was arguing that ultimately lamb is a really horrible translation here, because we think sacrificial lamb, even though what was it, a lamb that was in the great sacrifice of Yom Kippur? Was it a lamb that was killed in the Old Testament? No, it wasn't. We think of that. And what he was saying, what he was arguing was, lamb is a horrible word. Ram is a better word. It's not a lamb that's passive. It's a lamb that's active. It's a lamb that's fierce. This is a picture of a king. This is a picture of a conqueror. This is someone who's strong and will come in and take away the sin of the world. Of course, we automatically jump to that to say, well, what does it mean to take away the sin of the world? Well, it means forgiveness, right? But that's not the word here. It doesn't say anything about forgiveness. It's an entirely different word that's not used in that context. It's actually a word to say take away. What does he mean? Well, how does a conquering ruler take away the sin of the world? He goes and he kills all the evil people. Right? And so this is the context under which John is working. Now, we discussed a lot before in the past of how John the Baptist was absolutely right. He understood who Jesus was in terms of basic identity. He understood he was the Christ, but John the Baptist was far from fully clued in, just like everybody, right? The disciples, like John the Baptist, far from fully clued in. I mean, John the Baptist did not realize, for example, he was Elijah, even though Jesus said, that man's Elijah, right? We saw this before, whenever John starts having doubts. Are you really the one who is to come? This is John. He's expecting what most of the Jews are expecting. He's expecting the Messiah to come and kick tail. So I believe that is that. And Dodd's quote is, this Jesus is a Lamb of God, this gentle Jesus, in John's mind, and his quote, cannot be taken seriously. I think that's right. I think that's missing the historical point. We're actually taking ideas, the passive lamb, we're taking the ideas of the slaughter, we're taking the ideas of the takeaway of sin, and we're then importing that into a man who hasn't gotten there theologically yet. Because those ideas are not, Jesus hasn't taught those things yet. This is before Jesus' ministry, where he's actually conveying everything that he knows. Yeah, it's a fairly normal word for lamb.
For lamb or ram?
Either. It could be male, female. If you look in context of outside literature, that's really what you look for to see what could be the images that we're going for here. And it's very common for this lamb thing to not be passive. That is not actually, it seems to me, the primary image. The primary image is not a passive animal, but a very active animal. And we've talked before about some of the other literature within the context of Judaism at the time. That's what you see in that literature, and that's what you see in Revelation. The lamb who was slain, the slain part is what we tend to focus on and think that's his normal mode. But the reality is, the normal mode in Revelation is for him to be conquering, not for him to be passive. And so I think that actually fits in better here. So I can try to find you some other references if you'd like to see it. But it fits in a lot better with an understanding of what Judaism would be like, and even John. Because John obviously understood, was a true follower of God. Everybody knows that. John followed Jesus in that sense. He understood who Jesus was, sort of. But there's all sorts of things in John the Baptist's ministry to point out to say he didn't have, just like everyone else, he didn't have the full picture. And it wasn't till essentially the resurrection that anybody got it, other than Jesus. Nobody got it, really, until Jesus had resurrected. And you get Thomas saying, "My Lord and my God." So that's the intro. And this is the thing that's very different here than what you get in the other Gospels. Because in the first chapter, you've got a good mix of historical discussion in terms of John the Baptist, but you've got a very strong mix of abstract thinking. When we're talking about Jesus being the Word and the Word becoming flesh, we're not talking about we're just writing a history book. We are very clearly moving into the realm of theology and trying to communicate spiritual ideas much more than just Jesus went from here, A to B. So that's the beginning of John. And I think you see that flavor throughout John. So the first sign is the turning of water into wine. And everybody knows that one. This is also one of my favorite statements to, for those who want to say that all drinking is wrong, well, clearly not. Jesus turned the water into wine. But, whatever. Grape juice, yes, that's it. Grape juice makes people drunk. That's the first sign. This is, and it even labels it such. What does he call it? Verse 11 in chapter 2. This is the first of his signs Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. And after this, he went down to Capernaum and went on. So this was his first sign that he did according to the Gospel of John. Next, you have the discussion of the cleansing of the temple. Now, I looked through the Gospel of John, and Jesus does show up in the temple twice. But like we discussed last time, the actual cleansing, which I, like I said before, is poorly named. It's not a cleansing. It's image of destruction more than cleansing. Beginning of Gospel of John here. Ending of all of the other synoptic gospels, and ultimately what leads very clearly to Jesus' death in some of the other gospels. Here, it's at the beginning. Of course, you have chapter 3. We're still in the first sign. We haven't seen anything other than that. Chapter 3 is the very famous discussion of Jesus with Nicodemus. And then you have Jesus and the woman of Samaria. You get to the second section, the life-giving word, in verse 46. So when Jesus came into Cana of Galilee, where he had made the water wine, and at Capernaum, there was an official whose son was ill. So he's talking to Jesus, and he's, my son's ill. Will you please heal him? Jesus said to him, "Go, your son will live." So he just speaks it. He doesn't do anything to the son directly. He never sees him. "Go, your son will live." The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. And it was going down, his servants met him and told him that his son was recovering. So he asked them the hour when he began to get better. And they said to him, "Yesterday at the seventh hour, the fever left him." The father knew that that was the hour that Jesus had said to him, "Your son will live." And he believed all his household. And this was now the second sign that Jesus did when he had come from Judea to Galilee. So that begins the life-giving word. But it really doesn't end with that. If you look in the next chapter, this is where Jesus is talking to a lame man. What does he say in verse 8? Well, let's see verse 7. The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, and while I am going another steps down before me," because there was a legend that the first, after I believe it was an angel, touched the waters, the first to touch it would be healed. Jesus said to him, "Get up, take up your bed, and walk." And at once the man was healed, and he took up his bed and walked. So what is the life-giving word? Well, you've got 2 instances there of Jesus just speaking and healing. In the first case, he's giving the man actual life because he's dying. In the second, he's speaking without touching, and he's given a whole different kind of life where he's no longer lame. Third section, bread of life. And this has all sorts of, at least, typological signs to it. It starts with the feeding of the 5,000. We saw this, you see this in the other Gospels as well. And so, of course, there's the actual feeding of the 5,000, and then there's discussion, once again, of verse 22, about I am the bread of life. So you see in verse 26, for example, Jesus answered them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, you are seeking me not because you saw signs, but because you ate your fill in the loaves. Do not labor for the food that perishes, but for the food that endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you. For on him God the Father has set his seal." Also go back to verse 15. Notice this. This is, I think, very interesting. He feeds the multitude. What's their reaction to Jesus when he feeds them? Verse 15. "Perceiving that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself." So Jesus has his ministry and doing all sorts of wonderful things, and nobody gets it because they'd love to make him king. Who wouldn't, right? You live in a land, there's not all that much rain. You know, you might have famines. If you've got a guy who can give you endless food, or in our time, who could give you endless oil or money, whatever, why would you not want that man as king? So that's what they wanted to. But Jesus has an entirely different mode. He has no intention of becoming king and feeding the entire nation for the rest of his life and or killing any Gentiles that he happens to come across. That's not his way. So that's that section. Light and life, manifestation and rejection, 7 through 8. What you have here, if you have several different stories, several different interactions, and this is really getting us towards the crucifixion. This is really starting to set the stage for that, because you've got Jesus speaking and you've got people rejecting him, and you'll see this even more later on. But this is definitely part of it, like when you see in 7:32, the Pharisees heard the crowd muttering these things about him, Jesus, and the chief priests and Pharisees sent officers to arrest him. Two chapters. I'm not sure if there's a thread other than the purpose is for the gospel writer to point out that Jesus is being rejected. I think that's the general point. I mean, each of the stories have very important things in them themselves, and each have separate different spiritual points. I think perhaps the main theme, though, that the gospel writer is trying to really bring about here is the rejection of Jesus. And ultimately, this is why, one of the reasons why thematically, like textual critically, 752 or 753 through 8, is it 11? This is another reason why these verses don't actually fit in very well. We've talked about this at length before in terms of textual criticism. The earliest manuscripts do not have the story of the woman caught in adultery. It's a great story. Dan Wallace called it his favorite story, not in the Bible. That's the way he said it. Earliest manuscripts don't have it. Later ones did. It, of course, made it into our Bibles and has stayed there because of the prevalence of the King James Version and the early texts that are printed that had this in it. But we've discussed that at length before. Thematically, this is another case. It just really doesn't fit in with what the author seems to be doing here. But we won't discuss anything more about that until later if you want to. We've discussed that enough before at times. Now this ninth section, I find this one very interesting. This is judgment by the light, and we're going to see 2 examples. The first one read 9:1. As he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent us while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." So you see the theme. Light. Having said these things, he spat on the ground and made mud with saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with mud and said to him, "Go wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. And so what did he just do to this man? He was a blind man. He's now brought light to his eyes. Living in darkness, he's now brought this man light. Who is Jesus? Jesus is the light of the world. Now Jesus is the light to this individual because he gave him light, brought him in from darkness. And so this causes all sorts of issues. And this is once again getting into the leading up to the Passion story. All sorts of issues. Verse 13, they brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Now it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. So the Pharisees again asked him how he had received his sight. And he said to them, "He put mud on his eyes and I washed, and I see." Some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath." But others said, "How can a man who is a sinner do such signs?" And there was a division among them. So they said again to the blind man, "What do you say about him, since he has opened your eyes?" He said, "Well, he's a prophet." So the blind man, he gets it, but not fully. The Jews did not believe that he had been blind, and so they brought in his parents. And it says, you know, they brought his parents, they're like, "Yes, this is our son, he was born blind, but don't talk to us, talk to him," because they're afraid of the Jews. They've already heard of the plot. The Jews, they want to kill Jesus at this point. And so the parents are like, "He's of age, ask him." So that's the thing. So they brought him in again, and they said, "Give glory to God, we know this man is a sinner." He answered, "Whether he is a sinner, I do not know. One thing I do know, and though I was blind, I now see." And they said to him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" He answered them, "I have told you already," and he would not listen. "Why do you want to hear it again? Do you want to become his disciples?" And that just made them angry. And they reviled him, saying, "You are his disciple. We are the disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we do not know where he comes from." And of course, if you noticed a very strong theme in the Gospel of John, if you read it recently, Jesus is very frequently talking about his origin. He is doing that all of the time. They'll ask him and he'll say, "Yeah, you're right, if my judgment was alone, would not be valid, but it's me who judges and the Father. I and the Father are one." That is a very constant theme in John. And here you have the Pharisees going, "Well, we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but we do not know where this man comes from." The man answered, "Why, this is an amazing thing. You did not know where he comes from, yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, God listens to him. Never since the world began has it been heard that anyone opened the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." They answered him, "You were born in utter sin," because they're, you know, either he sinned or his parents sinned. That's why he was born blind, right? "You were born in utter sin, and would you teach us?" And they threw him out. So that's that story. And it goes on. And this really fits in with the theme once again. Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and having found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" He answered, "And who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?" Jesus said to him, "You have seen him, and it is he who is speaking to you." He said, "Lord, I believe," and he worshipped him. Jesus said, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and that those who see may become blind." Some of the Pharisees near him heard these things and said to him, "Are we also blind?" Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, 'We see,' your guilt remains." So what's the point of this nice little tidy story? We've got man who was blind. Jesus brings light to that man's eyes, that man can now see. And if it isn't obviously clear throughout the narrative, who are the people that are now blind throughout that discussion? It's the Pharisees. There's one man in this discussion. The parents don't, of course, They're too afraid to even say anything. But there's one man in the whole bulk of that chapter who is not blind, and it was the guy who had just gotten sight from Jesus. And so then it comes back to the very end where Jesus says, essentially, I came that those who could not see could see, and those who currently see would be, who are actually blind. And what's the point? With light, when light comes into the world, when the light of the world comes into the world, one of two things happen. Those whom are blind and God saves, they can see. But those who think they see will be judged. Because what can you do in the darkness? What can you get away with? You can get away with sin. But you can't get away with sin in context of the light. So Jesus is the light of the world, both heals and judges as the light. And both of them have to be there. And so that's the point of chapter 9. So light brings healing and light brings judgment all at the same time, depending who they are. Chapter 11. This is the sixth section, victory over death. Of course, death of Lazarus, everybody's quite familiar with this story. Lazarus is getting sick. Jesus is moving that way. Lazarus dies. Is it Martha or Mary that gets mad at Jesus? If you'd just been a little faster, you could have saved him. So Jesus comes, raises him anyway. Verse 38, Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. It was a cave and a stone lay against it. Does that sound familiar? Cave, stone lay against it? Jesus said, take away the stone. Martha, the sister of the dead man, said to him, Lord, by the time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days. Jesus said to her, did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God? So they took away the stone, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me. This is once again that pairing where Jesus is always, always talking this gospel about he and the Father. You always hear me, but I said this on account of the people standing around me, that they may believe that you sent me. When he said these things, he cried out in a loud voice, Lazarus, come out. The man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips and his face wrapped with a cloth. Jesus said to him, unbind him and let him go. Verse 45, many of the Jews, therefore, who did not come with Mary and had seen what he did, believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. So the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered the council and said, what are we to do? For this man performs many signs. And ultimately, verse 53, so from that day on, they made plans to put him to death. So at this point, it's very clear within the plot of the gospel, they're going to put him to death, which is an interesting juxtaposition. So let's say you're reading it for the first time. Death is still a major problem. We have not dealt with death up to this point. We've dealt with being maimed in terms of like being born blind. We've dealt with spiritual problems, but we've never dealt with anyone who was actually dead yet. Then Lazarus comes, and so you have this juxtaposition of Lazarus dies. Jesus conquers death, therefore the chief priests and the Pharisees want to kill him, want to make him die as well. So that's thematically what we're doing in the Gospel of John. We're setting ourselves up for resurrection. Why? How can you kill the man who can resurrect the dead? I guess is ultimately the question. How can you kill that man? So that's where we're going in the Gospel of John. And then the last section. The general belief was that when you die, you go to Sheol. Now, clearly there was life in Sheol that was not good, but there was life in Sheol that was good, living, for example, in Abraham's bosom. And you get that in the parable where you have, who are the two individuals? One is in suffering, one is in Abraham's bosom. What's that? The rich man and the beggar. The rich man is suffering, the beggar is in Abraham's bosom. That's generally the view. Now, in terms of resurrection at this point was fairly common in Jewish thinking. You started to get that thinking developed from Ezekiel, from like the Valley of Dry Bones. That's a very clear image of a resurrection kind of event. You also got it very clearly starting in this rough time period and a few hundred years before. And so the Pharisees believed in the resurrections. The Sadducees did not believe in the resurrection. That's why they were sad, you see, right? They did not. Horrible joke, I know. But it's good for remembering which one of them believed in the resurrection, which one of them didn't. So there is the Sadducees, no resurrection. So it depends on the group. The Pharisees, yeah, they would have believed in it. Now, where they would have had an issue is having individuals being raised from the dead. Because for them, resurrection was something you would expect, but would be of Israel. They did believe in the resurrection.
But what does that mean? Did they believe in a bodily resurrection? Or did they mean their souls?
They believed in a bodily resurrection.
And the Sadducees
believed in. No one, and this is, there's a book called Resurrection of the Son of God by N.T. Wright. It's a fantastic book. He basically belabored the point. There was no one in the ancient Jewish world who believed in a non-bodily resurrection. Jesus' views were unique, but that was not one of them. In terms of resurrection, they all believed in bodily resurrection. This was not, some people say this is a Christian invention, that idea. No, no, no. This is very normal. What was unique about Jesus' resurrection was not the fact that a human was resurrected, but that one man was resurrected before everyone else. That was not what anybody believed. Resurrection was something that happened way later in the future. Of course, they didn't believe it was Jesus because they thought he was a heretic because he contradicted Moses. That's another thing that was unique about Jesus in terms of his teaching. He obviously went different ways than and built upon the Old Testament scriptures. But Jesus was not the first one to talk about a physical resurrection of the body. Normal Judaism, unless you're a Sadducee. Then you wouldn't have it. So, yeah. And so the Lazarus thing, see, this would have been odd because they would not have expected this kind of thing, though it would be very impressive once they saw it, obviously. I would be very impressed if anybody rose anybody from the dead, that, especially if they'd been dead 4 days. You know, you go pull them out of the casket. That's something, right? How could you not be impressed by that? Those who were there were quite clearly impressed, but it didn't really fit in with what their MO, the way they thought. General resurrection in the future, but not individuals. And certainly not a Jesus raising, being raised by the Father. So, there's that. So the last section of the Book of Signs. This is chapter 12. And this is where we're, this is the last bit to get us into the Passion narrative. And it's almost like you could almost fit this one in with the Passion narrative and go with six signs. But so you've got Mary anoints Jesus of Bethany. And what does Jesus say? Of course, Judas wants to sell it and give it to the poor. Jesus says, "Leave her alone so that she may keep it for the day of my burial. The poor you have always with me, you always have with you, but you do not always have me." Of course, some of the Jews, next few verses, and you don't hear much more about this. If anything, if I remember, the Jews want to kill Lazarus because now Lazarus is a walking, talking testimony of Jesus. Let's kill that guy. That's what they're thinking. I wonder if they thought the same thing about the guy who had been made from blind to where he could see. Next, you have the triumphal entry. And so, let's say you Greeks seek Jesus, the Son of Man, and lift it up. And this is where you go from the implication of chapter 11 to the very explicit of chapter 12. Verse 27, "Now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour, but for this purpose I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name." Then a voice came from heaven, "I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again." The crowd that stood there and heard it said that it thundered. Others said, "An angel has spoken to him." Jesus answered, "This voice has come for your sake, not mine. Now is the judgment of this world. Now will the ruler of this world be cast out." Not in the far distant future will the ruler of this world be cast out. No. "Now is the judgment of this world. Now will the ruler of this world be cast out. And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself." Lifted up from the earth. What does that mean? Of course, they don't really understand it yet. "He said to this, show what kind of death he was going to die. So the crowd answered him, We have heard from the law that Christ remains forever. How can you say that the Son of Man must be lifted up? Who is the Son of Man? So Jesus said to them, the light is among you for a little while longer. While you walk, while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you. The one who walks in darkness does not know where he is going. While you have the light, believe in the light, that you may become sons of light. So you've got a very strong, very, very strong statement there of, I'm going to die and the Son of Man is going to be lifted up. Based on the events of chapter 11, you should think that Jesus should have no problem rising from the dead if he did die. But there, the primary focus of the lifting up is what? He said to show this by what kind of death he was going to die. And so then you get into the passion narrative proper with the washing of Jesus' feet in chapter 13, and then we get the what he called the book of the passion. So after that, like I said, you've got a number of discussions. And, you know, very, very commonly, one that we commonly talk about or reference, of course, is the high priestly prayer in John chapter 17. Then in chapter 18, you have the crucifixion starting to happen. Jesus is actually betrayed. Peter denies Jesus in that chapter. Jesus is questioned for the high priest. He's questioned before Pilate. Very important. 33 to 40. So you're a king, Jesus answered. You say that I'm a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. Pilate said to him, what is truth? After he had said this, he went back outside of the Jews and told them, I find no guilt in this man. And so Jesus says in verse 36, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting, and they might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from this world. And on that basis, Howe critiques a lot of premillennialism, and I think it's absolutely right, and some postmillennialism, and that is actually right. Jesus' kingdom is not of this world. Jesus' kingdom is spiritual. He had to tell it to Pilate because Pilate didn't get it either. But it's got, the explanations for that are really going to go pretty widely. Some are going to say it was physically heard, and so therefore Jesus said it out loud, and so therefore they would hear it. Some will say this is just the writing of John as he writes his spiritual gospel. This is spiritual material. Some would say it's revelation. So in terms of just general scholarship, I'm not sure where the largest consensus would lie. It's quite a long dialogue. And of course, people throw into the whole mix of how in the world could you remember all of this stuff? Of course, some people are automatically remember everything that they hear. But if I were to hear a statement like, you know, I can't listen to Hal and then write down what he says verbatim. I have to do what you guys were doing when I was giving you the list. And what was that last one again? No, the one before that. Now, what was the I'm the same way. And so that's something to throw into the mix as well, that people will throw in and say, okay, these really long dialogues, was John sitting there writing them? That seems unlikely. Though it's possible. Was John or the beloved disciple, whoever actually wrote this, whichever John it was he, could he remember everything he heard like that? Is it remembering the gist of what was said and then just writing out everything? Dr. Bach from DTS, he wrote an article once, Live, Jive, or Memorex, talking about the words of Jesus. And the question that he was really dealing with there with the gospel writers, and it's a great article to read. It's in, I'm trying to remember the book. I can't remember. This was one of the various books that came out that was trying to deal with some of the Jesus seminar. And what he was trying to argue was, it depends on the paragraph, it depends on the discussion, the nature of the thing. Some of them are, you would say they're like Memorex, means they were like recording. Some of them would be more like live talk, and that's why you get some variability between some of the Gospels, where you've got the main points, but some of the words, the tenses might change. There might be an added and or the or an extra word or something. So the question of exactly how this came about, though, that's ultimately very much up in the air, of exactly how this material got recorded, or if it was just at some point revealed later, or if he actually heard it audibly well enough to remember every single word. And so you've got discussions, and then you've got the actual passion and then the resurrection in chapter 20. I believe we're about out of time. I'll say this. You really want to call chapter 20, verse 30 and 31, the conclusion of the book, and then 21, something else. Now, Jesus did many other signs in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name, which is a fantastic conclusion to a book. And then there's another chapter. So that's why I call it an epilogue, because it's not really a closer. Verse 31 is a fantastic closer, because it doesn't seem to fit. This is why a lot of more critical scholars will say that 21 was added later. But unlike what you got at the beginning of chapter 8, we have no manuscript evidence for that, which means it's pure speculation. Chapter 8, not pure speculation. There's plenty of evidence. It's very clear. But here, if you're going to go that way, speculation. Could be true. It could have been that John wrote the book and then he added another chapter or another section to it. Could have been that somebody else did. Speculation. But conclusion really is verse 30, verse 31. Jesus did lots of other things that we were not privy to and did not get written into this book. So that's the Gospel of John. Very different than the Synoptics. Of course, Edward will talk about the Synoptics. I would say, hey, before next Lord's Day, read all the Synoptics, but a lot of reading. Do familiarize yourself with them. Skim through them. I would recommend doing what I sometimes do and just go through as long as you have a Bible with decent section headings, skim through it, like the ESV. My ESV has really good section headings. So I can skim through the Gospel of John or Luke or Matthew. I can say, okay, this is this and this and this and this. And I could see sort of the sequence of things and the major themes and whatnot. So at least I'd recommend spending some time doing that. If you don't have a Bible that does nice things for you like that, then get one. Don't stick with something that's not quite as helpful. So I used to think that, you know, these subheadings for the week, you don't need that kind of stuff. Study it yourself, but I was being an idiot. So, any last thoughts, questions?